Take a network break. Welcome to episode 44. Grab a coffee and a virtual donut and join us for an analysis of the latest IT news, vendor moves, and new product announcements. We'll separate the signal from the noise, or at least make some noise of our own. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and with me as always is Greg Farrow and Ethan Banks. And today we've got a special guest, Howard Marks, founder and chief scientist of DeepStorage.net. Howard, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well, although it's early in the morning out here in the mountains of New Mexico.
We woke you early, so we expect you to be grouchy.
Oh, I'm good at that.
Very good. So before we get started, I just want to say thanks to our sponsor. This week's show is sponsored by Sonus Networks. If you're looking to embed intelligence and security into your network, start with Sonus. All right, so let's get into it. First story coming from the Gartner, cloud infrastructure spending rises and non-cloud spending is flat.
Hardly surprising, right?
Yeah.
makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, well, if you read the article, of course, it's a little bit difficult to make sense of defining cloud. Private cloud, cloud, are we talking about hardware infrastructure for the cloud? Are we talking about cloud spending? Are we talking about software? Are we talking about, it's just, you know, I got lost in there about what actually they're talking about in cloud. Yeah, so there's a couple of things. The Business Wire report is probably the best one, I thought, which sort of summarized it. The IDC blog post sort of says, buy my expensive report for several tens of thousands of dollars, but the Business Wire press release associated with it says there's five top vendors, HP, Dell, Cisco, and EMC, selling cloud infrastructure. And a bit surprised to see Cisco listed as the third top worldwide cloud IT infrastructure vendor. There must be a lot of money in networking because they don't sell that many servers.
Yeah, and UCS. I think it's UCS too.
Well, UCS isn't that big for Cisco, right? It's not even $1 billion.
Yeah, but most of that $1 billion is in large installations. They sell a quarter as many servers as HP or Dell, but a much higher percentage of those go into service providers than...
Yeah, but we're talking numbers here, revenue in millions.
What I thought was interesting is that even though cloud revenues are growing and IT spending for non-cloud remains flat, if you look at the way they broke out the numbers, private cloud, they're counting as approximately 11 or 12 billion per year. Public cloud is 21 billion, but non-cloud IT infrastructure spending is 67 billion. So even though it's flat, it's still a substantially
bigger a big piece.
Yeah.
You know, and private cloud or infrastructure is a very gray line.
Well, I think the most interesting line in the Business Wire report is the ODM direct sales. So that is sales from direct to Amazon, Google, Facebook, etc., is $1.8 billion, more than double HP sales, more than three times what Cisco sells in this thing. The real money is not going to the big vendors. You might say the top five vendors in cloud infrastructure are HP, but the real biggest vendor is ODM direct, Quanta, and Avantech, and all those types of guys selling servers direct. And I mean, that, if you take that as a single market category, it's 30% of sales. So 30%, roughly 30% of hardware infrastructure and service is going directly into, to the things. And the vendors aren't getting a slice of that.
Uh-huh. Right.
Another stat in there that said NetApp was their market share dropped from 5.4% to 4.4%, although the revenue was about the same. Howard, what was your take on that?
NetApp has been sliding for a while. They're having trouble getting customers to adopt the cluster mode. They just haven't kept up. I've been really disappointed with NetApp in a lot of ways for the past 3 or 4 years. And if you look at how almost all of the modern storage systems are built, they're built around a log structure, and Waffle is built around a log structure and has been for 20 years. But NetApp let upstarts like Tintree say, wait, we'll reduce the size of the snapshot to a file instead of a whole volume. Therefore, you can snapshot one VM. And NetApp could have done that 3 years ago and just never dedicated the engineering resources to it.
So where did they put their engineering resources? We talked about this 3 or 4 weeks back about just what is NetApp failing to achieve? Because, I'm sure they've been doing some R&D for the last 4 years. Have they not? Have they been diverting money out of R&D into giving it back to shareholders and, packing up the business and going home?
That they're finishing the 15-year struggle to integrate Spinnaker. It's only this year that you could really say that was complete and now cluster mode is the future, but we've still got customers who aren't interested in cluster mode. I mean, a lot of them just because they don't get the benefit of scale. Hmm. You know, the other side seems to be that the traditionalists at NetApp have a way to politically kill projects off because they might threaten ONTAP. Yeah. And, you know, there's been the impression that there's a lot of defensive R&D instead of aggressive R&D going on.
Well, they don't seem to have any flash. Do they have an all-flash product?
Well, they have an all-flash version of the FAS.
Right.
They have the all-flash Ingenio E-Series.
Hmm.
So the E-Series is actually not a bad idea for I'm getting my data services higher up in the application stack and I just need go fast. And the FAS works fine. You know, the problem with both of them, more the EF than the FAS, is because they're all-flash versions of existing systems, they're not gentle to the flash.
Ah, okay.
And so
everybody else has gone out and built a proper flash system from the ground up, and NetApp's just shoved flash into its legacy products. And if it, you know.
The other guys have shoved flash into their legacy products as well. So, I mean, if you go to EMC, they've got a VNXF, which is the all flash VNX. And if you want that set of data services, then you go with that. And it's not as, you know, it doesn't give you quite as much performance or endurance out of the same amount of flash as something designed to be gentle on the flash like Extreme IO or Pure.
Yeah, I guess that. I mean, I just keep looking at NetApp and, well, all the storage companies, and somebody announced, one of the flash drive makers announced a 3 terabyte flash drive this week.
Samsung announced a 2 terabyte drive.
No, there was a 3 terabyte as well.
But SanDisk has had a 4 for a while.
I was listening to a podcast the other week where they're saying, you know, hard drives will never go away. And I'm just going like, really? I don't see, you know.
The hard drives aren't going to go away in the next 5 years. If you go to Newegg and you buy that $4,000 SanDisk drive, that thing's $2,700.
Mm-hmm.
And a 4 terabyte spinning disk is $270.
Yeah, but the enterprise drives that I buy for my storage arrays are $3,000.
That's because you're paying the EMC markup. HP or Dell or NetApp buys that drive. You know, if Newegg sells it for $385, they buy it for $300. And then they have to mark it up to $1,500 because they're going to give everybody a 50% discount to $750 and still have to make a profit.
To me, it's like if something's shipping today that's pro rata with an existing, you know, enterprise drive today, it's only a matter of time until it appears. I don't believe hard drives are going to be around in 5 years' time. I don't think they'll be around in 3 years' time.
It depends on how you define the market.
Yeah.
If we're talking about any application that needs, that does small IOs and needs random performance, then flash is the way to go. And the cost is affordable enough that you should just go that way.
Mm.
But, you know, if you're talking about medical imaging archiving or streaming video or any of a million other applications where it's large objects that are being read sequentially, disk costs a tenth as much and does that job just as well. And 5 years from now, it'll be not a tenth as much, but a fifth as much because both prices continue to fall.
Well, I think there's an acceleration here. I was talking to somebody about the cloud, and they're saying basically all of the servers that are in public clouds will be SSD within 3 years because the power savings justifies the extra expense.
Well, and because those servers store a lot of their data in something like S3 in the same data center.
Some news from Barracuda. I guess they got hammered by the market for moving into virtual appliances.
Yeah, this happened yesterday on the 9th of July. Barracuda announced its financial results. Their total revenues grew 18% year over year, which is pretty great, $78 million, with an operating income of $7.4 million. The challenge is that they're only predicting 8% growth in sales in the next grow. And then what they'd said in the online report was three things affected our total billings, that is the invoiced value of what was sold. Storage sales slowed down for Barracuda, which is interesting because QLogic announced poor results for its business and its share price fell 20% last week too, which signifies perhaps a trend. Second, sales of virtual appliances reduced short-term revenue. because sailing volume of the short of a virtual appliance is significantly cheaper than a hardware one, and then of course the stronger US dollar. So out of those, storage sales, not much they can do about that because everybody's the storage business seems to be shrinking fairly rapidly in the mid-size space, which is where Barracuda and QLogic say, and potentially at the upper end, we just haven't seen news coming out of the others. The stronger US dollar shouldn't really affect Barracuda because I checked and 75% of its revenue comes from the US, so offshore revenue is only 25%. And the discussion from the analysts was how much impact is virtual appliances going to have, and they said it'll be 3 years before we return to the sort of volume. If we shift to virtual appliances, we make far more profit, but we make far less invoicing value. The reason I wanted to bring that up is because I've been on the podcast talking about how the impact of virtual appliances will significantly impact investors in big companies. So companies like Cisco and Juniper, as we move from hardware routers to software routers for a large volume of devices, their total revenue will shrink and shrink dramatically before they recover in the future. So it could be 3 to 5 years before profit margins sustain and the revenues stabilize.
Yeah, but what you just said about Barracuda was that their profit margin went up, but their top line went down.
And the way that virtual appliances work, and this is the same with vSAN, by the way, is that when you sell the hardware, not only do you get a massive capital injection in year one, you also get a year-on-year maintenance contract behind it, which you can then bring forward. So with a bit of fancy accounting, you can bring a five-year maintenance contract and bill it all in year one. And when you go to a virtual appliance, you can only invoice it once, and then there's only a software support contract. The flip side, of course, is costs are very low. You can shipping right. license keys really cheap. But the top line value shrinks. So instead of selling 100 million of something, now all of a sudden you're selling 60 million. It's that missing 40 million that your share price is being punished for. The profit margins are roughly the same.
Yeah, my point is just I don't understand it. You know, if I sell $100 million worth of stuff and I spend $60 million in COGS, so I get $40 million net, why that's less good than just selling $40 million to ship licenses.
Because because companies are valued on their sales, so they're often – it's profits to earnings. So if your earnings reduce, then sometimes – but your profits stay the same. It's actually a good thing, but it's also a bad thing. So
again, the stupidity of Wall Street.
Yes.
I'd rather own shares in a $10 million company with an 80% profit margin than an $100 million company with a 10% with an 8% profit margin.
There's also a risk as the business changes that the company won't make the transition.
Yeah, so that's true.
I see this as evidence of, you know, virtual appliances is going to shake up the industry, and it's going to be if I'm Cisco or EMC or, you know, whoever, these software appliances are going to undermine my top line revenue and my shareholders are going to get revolt.
Well, that's interesting. We'll check on this news then. Cisco is investing in a networking software company, Sixwind, which has software that lets you create virtual appliances.
I did a little bit of homework on these guys to see what they're doing and what Sixwind is. They're a company that sells to OEMs, and they're selling software that does virtual networking really fast on x86. Which is interesting. You'd think, well, any of the big vendors could do this, right? I mean, but the answer is no.
Is that what Viata does?
No. Viata's in that space, yeah. They have virtual routers, and yeah, performance is one of their hallmarks. Juniper with the VMX appliance has done pretty well with throughput, really putting some big numbers to the VMX appliance. A lot of the other ports that vendors have done of their hardware boxes to software, they don't perform all that well. And so this is where Sixwind comes in. They say, we've got a solution where we can that we can sell you. You embed it in your stuff and make your stuff go really fast. There's two flavors of it. They've got a bare metal version, and then they've got a hypervisor version if you want to stand up other software alongside of their appliance-level offerings. They've got a router. They've got an IPsec appliance. Again, the whole idea, lots of throughput through x86, which has traditionally been hard. And where Cisco particularly, they always point back to, we make custom silicon and that's what we're good at. We want to sell you a box. So this does kind of point Cisco in a different direction. They're saying, long term, we know we need to do well with virtual appliances. And I see it as a interesting addition to probably ACI long term. That kind of dovetails in with M-Brain in a way. M-Brain is that lifecycle management for virtual appliances. And then they also have a number of, they ended up going down layer three, but initially it was layer four through seven appliance offerings that integrate very tightly in ACI. Well, imagine that coupled with six-win technology. So you get super high throughput. And now with an ACI buy, you could be getting not just what ACI is today, the APIC controller, Nexus 9000s, and all of the management that goes along with that to do end-to-end flows across your data center in a virtualized way. Now you also get high performance for a number of applications as well. Hmm. So I think it's Cisco looking to the future.
It is. So, and Cisco makes a lot of investments in different companies. I'm a little bit dubious here. So Sixwind is a long-term, like it's been around for 10 or 15 years doing high-performance operating systems, and particularly it's got a high-performance networking stack aimed at appliances. But what we've also seen more recently is companies like Cloudflare and Fastly publishing blog posts and videos on how they've managed to take a standard Linux kernel, just change some of the settings to optimize it and run it at 10 gigabits per second line rate on every NIC, and even at 40 gigabits per second on some fairly standard servers. And we've also seen companies, open source projects like SNAB, that's S-N-A-B-B, is able to run well over 10 gigabits per second, and it's a virtual appliance. In fact, it's a whole platform. The only thing you have to do to, once you've got a SNAB appliance, is to start to write in Lua how you want to mund your packets. So if you want to load balance, if you want to groom, if you want to IPS, you just build them all on top of SNAB. So the interesting thing about this whole VM, you know, appliance business is open source is a viable market here, and it's not necessary for Cisco to actually go and buy proprietary solutions here. They could just turn to open source and add value to them instead of trying to own the whole stack.
So what makes you think Cisco went this route instead of just grabbing something from open source?
I think Cisco, there's two parts of Cisco. There's part of Cisco that wants to participate in open source and wants to contribute back to open source. But there's a much bigger part of Cisco, which is the old Cisco. We own everything. We do it all ourselves. We do the hardware. We do the software. And we don't let anybody in, and we take all the revenue for ourselves. We don't share with anybody because only we are the smartest people on earth to be able to do this. And, you know, they're being, you know, I can point
to Microsoft.
Or lots of companies, right? But to me, there are plenty of open source projects out there that can build networking appliances that anybody can contribute to that work as good as or better than these sort of 10-year-old projects built in a different way before open source got around.
It's good to point out this wasn't a Cisco acquisition. This was an investment.
Right.
I think it was $100 million in, right?
Yes.
So those are different things. I mean, this is a strategic bet, not a we want to own this and we're going to start doing something with the technology. Mm. It's a long-term play.
It's like,
As you said before, Greg, I mean, what Cisco is known for essentially is not necessarily innovating, but seeing a market develop, seeing it grow to a certain extent, and then moving in hard. And maybe they feel like on the open source side, they're content to sit and let it watch, and they'll make some side bets here and there.
And you can take a stake in Sixwind and prevent anybody from doing something to blindside you.
Yes.
So, you know, what if a competitor took Sixwind and started to use it? You know, if you own a part of Sixwind, it can't go anywhere without talking to you first.
Yes.
Yeah, so I've talked to some people who observe Cisco's interaction with certain open source projects, and they pointed out Cisco invests some sort of either time or money into a number of different open source projects, even ones that compete with each other. And the speculation that, you know, what's the motivation here to be doing that? Why don't they back one project or another and not back multiples? And the idea is they're just letting the sharks eat each other, hoping that none of them end up making any major headway, and it puts them back in the catbird seat.
And if any of them do, they're sufficiently involved that they won't be blindsided.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a hedging strategy. Sticking with open source, Mirantis this week rolled out integrated OpenStack hardware system. If you want OpenStack and you want a little handholding, Mirantis has something for you.
Oh, hyperconverged is so yesterday. I'm so tired of conversion.
It's already done. I want something else.
Well, just to back
that
up,
Greg, I got to make a living somehow.
just to give you some background there. I mean, hyperconverged is becoming a bit overdone, and in fact, there is an IDC, and there was a link in the show notes that showing that hyperconverged sales or integrated systems, as IDC calls it, not one to use anybody else's language and make up their own words, IDC, has already flattened out. And maybe it isn't going to go anywhere. So I am a little bit cynical about hyperconverged and whether it's a long-term play.
I think my feeling has always been that hyperconverged really is kind of like blade servers. It's a 30% solution. It's the right thing to do for remote offices and branch offices, but that it's not, you know, the despite what the folks at Nutanix tell us about, oh, look, it's web scale. We're doing this just like Google. Google doesn't spread the storage layer across thousands of their servers like mayonnaise on a sandwich. You know, they build storage out of servers, but there are servers that do storage and there are servers that do compute. They don't mix the two together. I did see, you know, there was another company, Breakwater, who, of course, spells it Breqwater. That's doing a hyperconverged OpenStack appliance. I think Mirantis is aiming more at rack scale and going for where OpenStack actually makes sense. You know, I don't know, in a remote office with four servers, why you need an orchestration layer for provisioning new VMs.
Well, Cisco's got IntiCloud, which is an integrated stack. You can buy a, you know, their distro of OpenStack, and it runs on their InterCloud thing, and it's both. There are public cloud versions and private cloud versions of that. I suspect Mirantis is struggling with enterprises buying their package and then trying to run it on servers. Plus, you know what? Remember what I said about hardware sales being addictive for top line revenue? And if I was an investor in Mirantis, and Mirantis was, you know, I could get $10 million more dollars at the bottom line in volume by selling hardware from Dell or somebody else, I might just be tempted to do that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that who Mirantis brought in. It's Dell gets the compute and storage, and then it's Juniper doing the networking component.
Yeah, Dell doesn't get the networking too, which really struck me as interesting because you'd think, well, Dell's messaging has been big around open networking, and they've talked a lot about their switches that you can now run whatever compatible network operating system you want on top of. And so you'd think, logically, this all kind of plays together. You run an some kind of an open network operating system on a Dell switch that's paired up with Dell storage and Dell compute all in a unified package. But no, Dell doesn't get the networking. Juniper does. So they're actually putting Juniper QFX 5100s as the data path in there, and then a Juniper EX 3300 for management, the QFX being one of the big beefy switches. That does all the things. It does any fabric flavor that Juniper will offer you. It does Puppet and Chef. It's got support for that. It can be a VTAP, a VXLAN tunnel endpoint. And it's clearly running Junos, though. And I'd love to know a little bit of the integration that Mirantis did. And I'm speculating here that it's Junos's API that got Mirantis all excited and is being taken advantage of.
What about Contrail? Maybe
sure
they put Contrail in there?
I didn't read anything about Contrail, but that certainly would make sense.
Because if Mirantis is using Contrail to do the OpenStack networking, that would make sense then because, you know, the hardware.
Maybe that's something on the drawing board. I think this is a good time to talk about our sponsor, Sonos. Sonos brings intelligence and security to real-time communications, such as voice and video. Sonos isn't a startup. They've been around for a while, offering hardware-based and virtualized session border controllers, diameter signaling controllers, software-defined networking capabilities, policy and routing servers, and media and signaling gateways. Greg, do you want to tell them about NAS IQ?
Yeah, sure, but Drew. The Sonos NAS IQ is an application-aware platform that provides real-time control of the network itself. And like, so what it does is it is an appliance that sits at the edge of your network and it sees all of the flows, not packets, but flows. And it's got a deep packet inspection engine that allows you to tweak the way your private network works by virtualizing the network and being application-aware. So it can give priority to voice traffic based on business rules, not by some access list or some filtering process or four-tuple policy-based routing type thing. You manage the network bandwidth intelligently, and then you give it a policy so that the sensitive traffic, which might be voice or it could be anything, is just where you want it to be. This reduces the need to over-provision your WAN, and you can even probably reduce your private WAN pipe while still getting the quality you require for your sensitive apps. And smaller WAN pipes means less money spent.
So you can learn more about how Sonos turns business connectivity into business continuity with NAS IQ. You can visit Sonos at www.sonos.net or call 855-GO-SONOS, that's 855-GO-SONOS, and tell them you heard about it on Packet Pushers.
So just to pick up on the topic where we were before we jumped to the Sonos ad there, there's a number of articles on Mirantis website where they have partnered with Juniper for Contrail. They've done a number of webcasts and released different articles. So it's possible that this particular thing is using Contrail.
Ah, that's a good connection point to make. Yeah, that makes sense.
I wonder, do you guys feel like there's enough OpenStack demand that, and what's been holding people back is this hardware integration piece?
There's a very well-entrenched process of risk management, if you want, and I'll put that in inverted commas, slap you up the upside of the head sort of thing, you know, like that risk management is done by buying everything from one company, and then you've only got one throat to choke and they're responsible for making it work. Uh-huh. So if you're buying Mirantis from over here and networking equipment from here and servers from your HP and you've got to bring them all together and then it doesn't work and you don't know how to fix it, you want to blame somebody. And what you really should be doing is, you know, and I'm going to go down my, you should have humans to help you solve this. You should have enough resources in-house to do troubleshooting. But what they're doing is saying, well, we can manage that risk by getting it all from one vendor and paying twice as much as we would have so that they can do all that for us. They'll do validation testing and da-da-da. And so I think it's that one throat to choke idea is coming back and haunting us once again.
Greg, this is corporate America. I have plenty of money in my hardware acquisition budget, but I have $0 in my hiring smart people to implement OpenStack budget. So I'm going to outsource it to Mirantis because it's easier than convincing senior management that I need to hire smart people. You know, there's some pent up demand in corporate America for OpenStack as a cheaper alternative to VMware. And there's an impression that's not entirely untrue in corporate America that OpenStack requires you to hire three of your own PhDs. And and if going with Mirantis or Breakwater means that I only have to hire one of my own PhDs, even if the total dollar outlay is greater, then if the project doesn't work out, I don't have to figure out what to do with these three PhDs.
Yeah, we've talked about that plenty of times, but it's not actually PhDs. The trick that we're down to now in corporate IT is that you might have four people in your team. If you could hire one more, you could increase your productivity by 25%. Where else could you spend so little money to increase productivity? You could spend $2 million on a proprietary vendor-approved solution, or you could spend $200,000 on a new headcount and increase your output and productivity by 25%. So I take your argument, and I do believe that's what people say, but I think it's false. Ethan, you were going to say something?
I'm just going to point out that as far as OpenStack and network integration, a lot of vendors have gone to a lot of trouble to integrate with Neutron, and there's a lot of demonstrations on how to do that. But to go back to Greg, your point, and Howard, somewhat your point, there is human infrastructure required to make that work no matter what. So it's still a thing, although we've gotten so far afield, Drew, I've forgotten the original question.
Well, it makes me wonder. I mean, if you're thinking about OpenStack, then clearly you have a sense of, you know, this isn't just plug and play. I'm going to need to have some human resources to help me run this. And maybe by going with a converged system, I can take away some of that effort, but still bring some people in as opposed to paying, you know, X amount more for a VMware or a Cisco solution. So I don't know, are people coming to this because they want converged? Are people coming to this because they want OpenStack? Are people coming to this because they see an opportunity? I can get some private cloud going and maybe also increase my headcount because I need to bring in some folks to help me run this.
People are going because they want OpenStack. You know, if they just, you know, converged has the huge benefit that in most corporate environments it gets on the floor faster. Mm-hmm. If you order a FlexPod, that will be up and running VMs a month or two faster than if you sat down and ordered the same servers and the same networking and the same NetApp storage and sent one of your guys to work on it, because that guy who's doing the integration is going to get dragged away to fight fires every few minutes.
I think that if you're going to do that, you might as well go and buy VMware and pay the big bucks. The real thing around OpenStack is it's an alternative to VMware for most enterprises, and one at which the cost point is far more practical.
Agreed.
Right. And so what you need to be able to say to yourself is, sure, I might be saving, you know, millions by not buying VMware, but I need to invest some money in headcount. And if you're going to take on OpenStack to avoid spending money, avoid capitalizing with incumbent vendors, be prepared to spend up on OpenStack. Don't go down the path of turnkey. I think that's a bit fallacious argument.
Okay. Well, we'll keep an eye on this, and interesting to see Mirantis going this route. Yeah. We've got a couple more stories to wrap up with. They're both storage, Greg, so please be patient with us.
Hey. I had to get something in here.
First, Symantec might be putting Veritas on the block. There's talk they're going to sell it off to private equity for $7 to $8 billion, which is interesting considering they bought it back in 2005 for $13.5 billion.
They're definitely splitting up. You know, just like HP, they said they were going to split into two companies, but they haven't named a CEO for Veritas, and the rumors are floating around that somebody from private equity is going to come in and buy it and appoint a CEO. The problem is that, you know, like some other companies, there's been a huge brain drain at Veritas over the past 6 or 7 years. You know, the people who created things like Storage Foundation are just gone. Mm. And so, of course, when we started moving storage resources from the host into the storage system, the guys who did the volume manager that let all those Unix machines do their own storage systems fell off.
And so how does Veritas survive when we're seeing companies like, you know, these data-driven storage companies who are actually intelligently doing it? You know, their business, the Veritas business is built on backup and recovery, and to some extent archiving and e-discovery, but now we're seeing storage arrays have that built into them.
That's a long-term trend. Mm-hmm. That's going to take a long time. And, you know, when I talked to, you know, a whole new group of those companies just popped up, you know, Rubrik and, well, not so much Hedvig, but a couple guys just came out in the past month or so. Cohesity was the other one. And they're all taking very limited slices. You know, Veeam has had a big impact on Veritas income because if you're a small shop and all you have is VMs, Veeam is a better solution than Backup Exec was.
Orders of magnitude better.
But you know, not to mention the debacle around Backup Exec 2010, where they not only changed the user interface, but they changed the whole paradigm of the program, and the existing users revolted and said, you know, we just want a new version of what we have.
I mean, I look at Veritas and I think, you know, it's incumbent, it's been there forever, but I'm not sure that it's relevant going forward. Does the company stay relevant in the next 5 years when, you know, you've got so many storage companies coming up and innovating at a far faster pace than Veritas?
Well, I think this is why they went private equity, because Veritas, according to the story, they've got revenue of $2.5 billion, which is, you know, decent, but slow growth. So what a private equity company does is they, you know, slice a lot of fat, trim it down hard, put a little bit of shine on it, and see if they can sell it off to some sucker later.
Well, yeah, they could just put it into rent extraction. $2.5 billion of revenue, you could just put it into rent extraction mode and cut the R&D, cut the product development, keep the minimum level of support, and extract rent off it.
Yeah.
The problem is with both of those schemes mean that I'm going to make a lot of money over the next 5 years, and after that, it's going to fall off dramatically.
Sure.
And, you know, there is the problem with all of the new innovative backup guys is they don't scale and they don't cover a broad enough range of systems. And so Networker and TSM and NetBackup and Commvault stay around because of the massive breadth of stuff that they can manage to back up. You know, most of these new guys, when you ask them simple questions like, you know, what happens when somebody calls and says, I lost the spread, you know, we in accounting lost the spreadsheet we used to close.
So you're just supporting the rent extraction model. What you're saying is big companies who are operating at scale, who can't change easily, I could just keep them under support, increase the cost of software maintenance, and just take rent extraction off them and do very nicely and just leave the rest of it to the smaller part of the market.
You know, if your goal is short-term income, then, you know, you just become CA and be as evil as possible.
That's the rent extraction model. Yeah.
That's private equity. Short-term income and be as evil as possible.
And so, you know, you become CA, but even CA spun off ArcServe because they had extracted as much juice as there was from that little
All right. Some other storage news. EMC is looks like it's starting to divest itself of Syncplicity, which is a file sync and share business that the company acquired back in 2012.
Which is pretty interesting because EMC was is the big storage company, and so it bought Syncplicity with the expectation that all the companies in the world wouldn't go to Dropbox or Box, which are the two companies doing consumer storage, and EMC would be able to take all of that enterprise storage and people would buy it all from EMC because only EMC has able to do storage at enterprise level, and nobody bought it. And Dropbox and Box have done very, very well in businessizing or turning their businesses into enterprise capabilities.
They've come some ways. Syncplicity was actually an interesting product. It had a lot better security and auditing and all the business stuff that you care about than Dropbox for Business does. But it was a mixed on-premise, off-premise solution as well. You know, my feeling is that, you know, what I really want to see is over the long term, sync and share become just another protocol. That the problem we've gotten ourselves into with using Dropbox or Box or even Syncplicity is I've got the filer because in the home office where there's 500 people in the building, syncing and sharing between those 500 people is really stupid. you don't want 500 copies of that file. You want one copy of that file in one place that's authoritative.
You don't. You actually want 500 copies of it. You want it synchronized wherever it needs to be. That's the point of Dropbox is that you've got one master replication location, but everything's around the place.
You want to support the network traffic of synchronizing 500 copies of a file when somebody spell checks it within the building?
Sure. Why not? Networking's cheap. Bandwidth is cheap. Storage is cheap.
So now
it's the management of the network and the management of the storage that's expensive.
Now all those desktops have to have 4 terabyte hard drives instead of 256 gig SSDs because every one of those desktops has to have a copy of every file the guy who works that desktop would ever touch.
That sounds like a win.
Yeah. Now imagine that in a VDI environment.
Yeah.
Well, where it just doesn't work.
Sure, and then you have a storage system that then dedupes, right? But my point is that, well, I guess ultimately I'm sitting here looking at this and thinking, no doubt EMC expected Syncplicity to run on top of its EMC storage. And I can't see how you could ever make a file storage product or a service like Box or Dropbox on EMC's proprietary hardware. The numbers just don't work. It's profit prohibitive.
So they were hoping for some internal synergy and it didn't work out.
Yes, I would say that EMC hoped to put Syncplicity on top of EMC arrays and customers would pay expensive licensing fees to have an in-house. And you know what everybody did was they said, oh, we'll just go to Dropbox and Box because it's 1/15th the price and it's running on commodity equipment, open source software and uses cloud resources wherever possible and it's just priced at a point that EMC can't compete with.
And a lot of those decisions were made outside the IT department so that EMC sales force with their Gucci loafers and Armani suits didn't get to talk to the guy who was saying, you know, we'll just use Dropbox.
Yeah, what didn't EMC have a consumer storage? I can't remember the name of it. I keep forgetting that.
They bought iOmega.
And Mosey, right?
Mosey. Yeah. Yeah.
Mosey, they haven't sold off, which seems really strange because it was really consumer. Yeah. What I'm looking for really is a on-premises sync and share that's a gateway to the file server for those people in locations where syncing is the right access method. They're accessing the same data.
Wow. But I'm just looking at the price on Mosey. That's absolutely horrendous. £2,600 per year for 1 terabyte of storage. That's like... Oh, holy
hell. Hello, Fresh Plan.
Hello, yeah. I mean, Dropbox, I'm paying $100 a year for 1 terabyte of Dropbox, and they want nearly $4,000?
It's the power of the cloud.
I've made my point. Drops the mic. Yeah, that's right.
And with that, Greg Farrow is out. All right, well, I think this brings us to the end of another network break. My virtual donut is done. Thanks, Howard, for joining us. Where can folks find you on the internet, Howard?
They can find me at networkcomputing.com, although not nearly as often as I used to be. They can find me at deepstorage.net, And they can find me at all sorts of webinars I've got scheduled over the next few weeks. And in person, I'll be speaking at the Flash Memory Summit and at VMworld.
All right. I highly recommend seeing Howard in person. He's a great speaker. Greg, how can folks find you?
People can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com and on the Twitters is at etherealmind.
Ethan?
At EC Banks and ethancbanks.com. And you might also be interested in the Datanauts podcast, which you can find up on packetpushers.net that I do with Chris Wall. We cover storage and a lot of the sort of topics we covered today.
Yeah, and I'll make a plug for that too. The upcoming episode is about OpenStack. So if our OpenStack conversation intrigued you, you can find out a lot more through that podcast. You can find me, Drew Connery Murray, on Twitter at Drew_CM. Thanks again to our sponsor, Sonus Networks. If you're looking to embed intelligence and security into your network, start with Sonus. And as always, Network Break is powered by Virtual Donuts. Virtual Donuts, it's like porn, but for your mouth.
That was great.